The public will not learn of your presence at our meetings, for the few participants are people of discretion and will avoid doing anything that might harm you. So you needn't worry about agreeing to come." I could not deny the force of his arguments. He was right. If we clergymen who aspire to teach and guide the people refuse to make a personal investigation of the truth of such manifestations as he had described, who else is there to make it? Who could be more vitally interested in these matters than the clergy of all creeds? For if Spiritism were to prove to be true, it would be of utmost significance for every religious community. Consequently, after some hesitation, I agreed to go to the meeting that was to be held on the following Sunday evening. For the next few days my mind was constantly busy with the subject. At times I regretted having accepted the invitation, as the unpleasant consequences that my action might bring upon me loomed ever larger in my imagination, the more I thought about them. Anxiously I awaited the coming Sunday. After the conclusion of the afternoon divine service, I went to the city, intending to take care of a few pressing matters at the office of the charitable organization before going to the meeting. In my coat pocket I carried a slip of paper on which I had jotted down the questions I intended to ask the boy that evening. Being of a theological nature, they would require rather lengthy answers. I myself was unable to answer them and merely wanted to find out what explanation the boy would have to offer. On arriving at the office, I found a letter from the man who had invited me to the meeting. In it he said that the meeting would be held, not, as originally planned, at his home, but at that of another family whose address he gave. It had been so ordered. This unexpected change surprised me and aroused my suspicions. Was I being trifled with? The family to whose residence the meeting had been transferred I did not know even by name. Should I risk embarrassment among utter strangers? Perhaps, after all, the whole thing was a trap set for me. I made up my mind not to go. In order not to keep the gathering waiting for me in vain, I sent a messenger to the man with a note stating that I could not attend the meeting. It was not long before he appeared at the office in person, asking me to reconsider. He said that the change in the place of meeting had been no doing of his, but had been ordered from a source that must be obeyed, and that perhaps the reason for the change lay in the fact that the meeting would be less likely to attract attention at the other house than it would at his own. In the end, I went. It was 7:30 when we arrived. I was cordially greeted by the family and could see that they were pleased at my coming. Since the meeting was not to begin until 8, I had ample opportunity to talk with the boy, who had also arrived beforehand. I asked him a number of questions to enable me to judge the extent of his learning, and found that in this respect he was no different from the average youth of his age. 14. The séance began at 8 o'clock. There were only a few of us, and I was surprised to find that the gathering was not to be held in the dark, as I had supposed was customary at séances, but that the room was left brightly lighted. The opening consisted of a short prayer offered with great reverence by one of those in attendance. In fact, all the participants appeared to be deeply in earnest and inwardly composed. No sooner had the prayer ended than the boy fell over forward with such a sudden jerk and loud exhalation of breath that I was startled. Had he not been supported by the arm of the chair in which he was seated, he would have fallen to the floor. After only a few seconds he was pushed upright in a series of jerks as though by an invisible hand, and remained sitting with his eyes closed. I could feel my heart beating faster in anticipation of what was about to happen. "Grüe Gott, God's greeting," he began, and immediately turned to me with the question, "Why have you come here?" He used the familiar form du, which took me aback, as under ordinary circumstances the boy would never have dared to take this liberty. "I came in search of the truth," I replied. "I heard of what takes place at these meetings and want to satisfy myself personally whether these things are true or false." "Do you believe in God?" he went on and added, without waiting for an answer, "I know you do, but I want to ask you another question. Why do you believe in God?" This question was so unexpected that I scarcely knew what to say. I had a feeling, too, of being confused, and consequently answered so inadequately that I was myself thoroughly dissatisfied with my answer. "I had expected something better of you," He responded calmly, a remark which hit me like a slap in the face. I had come with the idea of exposing a piece of charlatanism, but in the first minutes I had been put to shame. The question that you have answered so unsatisfactorily we will return to later, he said gently, and now it is your turn to ask me questions. I will answer them as far as I am permitted. You have with you a written list of the questions you want to put to me. Take out the slip on which you wrote them. The others looked at me with amazement, for no one had known of my list. My first question read, why is it that Christianity seems no longer to exert any influence upon the people of today? Without a moment's reflection or hesitation, he began his reply. Incidental questions put to him or objections raised by other of his hearers he answered with amazing simplicity and clarity. According to my shorthand notes, his statement ran as follows. The teachings of Christ in the documents that have come down to you are no longer complete nor are they in their original purity and clarity. In what is called the New Testament, a number of important sections have been omitted, indeed, entire chapters have been removed. What you have now are mutilated copies. Not knowing the originals, you are unable to determine what those mutilations are. Those who were guilty of these mutilations have been severely punished by God. One of those present asked who it was that had thus mutilated the Holy Scriptures. That does not concern you, was the curt answer. It is sufficient for you to know that it happened and that God has punished the culprits. What would it profit you to learn their names? You would only use the information to pass judgment upon them, and you know that you shall not judge your fellow man. God judges, that is enough. Even a letter written by the Apostle Paul to all the Christian congregations has been destroyed. In it he had carefully explained those passages in his earlier writings that had given rise to misunderstandings. But his explanations were not in accord with many erroneous doctrines that had subsequently crept into the Christian faith. At this point I asked him when it was that the first views that conflict with the true teachings has found their way into the Christian religion, to which he replied. To a small extent as early as the first century AD, as you know, even during the lifetime of the apostles there were more than a few differences of opinion among the Christian congregations. Later, many erroneous human opinions and dogmas that do not agree with Christ's teachings were introduced. If you had the complete and unadulterated text of Christ's doctrines, many a load imposed by man in the name of religion and Christianity would be taken from your shoulders. Many a doctrine that you are expected to believe, even though it seems out of all reason, would be discarded because it would be recognized as being wrong, and you, as God's children, could again breathe freely. As it is, millions of people feel that much of what is being taught today as a part of the Christian faith cannot be true. From force of habit, they may conform outwardly, but there is no inner effect, for they lack true conviction. There are many today who do not profess even outward adherence to Christianity. Instead of rejecting only those parts of it that are untrue, they discard altogether their belief in Christianity and in God, because they think that these things are all of one piece, and that is terrible. But the time will come when the teachings of Christ will be restored to mankind in their full purity and truth. In what way this will happen, you need not know for the present. Moreover, the originals of the documents of the New Testament, even where they have been preserved, have been altered in more than a few places. The copyists substituted words and whole phrases, left out a word here or inserted one there, thus altering the sense of the text to suit their purposes. In most cases, they were trying to create passages in the Bible that would lend support to the religious views of their times, and to that end they falsified its text. They were not always conscious of the magnitude of their offense, but believed, rather, that they were serving the cause of religion. In this way the people were misled, and many of them feel in their hearts that they are not on the right path, even if they do not have the opportunity for clarification. The necessary consequence is that a religion so deprived of its roots can no longer exert any fruitful influence. Every doubting of the truth reduces its effect. May I ask you, I interposed with a feeling of apprehension, to point out a place in the New Testament in which a word has been changed or omitted, thus falsifying the sense of the text? While this is not the right moment, he replied, for me to go into the subject of these falsifications. I shall do that later when I come to explain the Bible as a whole. I will grant your request and name two places, one in which a word has been replaced by another, and one where a word has been omitted entirely. You are familiar with the exclamation of the Apostle Thomas, as rendered by your modern Bible, "My Lord and my God." John 20, 28. As a matter of fact, however, Thomas used the form of address always employed by the apostles towards Christ, "My Lord and Master." The word Master was later altered into God. Why this was done, I shall explain on a later occasion. A phrase from which a word was omitted and thereby its whole meaning changed should be of great interest to you personally, since you are a Catholic priest and believe that you have the power, as such, to pardon sins. What passage in the New Testament do you cite to support the claim that such power was conferred upon priests? I recited the following passage: "Whomever you forgive their sins, they are forgiven them." He corrected me, quoting the passage verbatim, "If you forgive the sins of others, they will be forgiven them," and went on. The Greek word which you translate as them also has the meaning of selves. Now, in the original text the word your stood before the word selves. What today is rendered as them was actually yourselves. So in the original the passage reads, "If you forgive the sins of others, they are forgiven to yourselves." You can see how the sense of this passage has been distorted by the omission of the word your. Christ here said nothing but what he had said repeatedly elsewhere, namely, you must in your hearts forgive your fellow men the failings and sins which they have committed against you, so that you may obtain forgiveness from God for your own sins. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Forgiveness is the hardest task in your lives, and it is for this reason that God gives you his special aid for the purpose. Christ, as you know, says in the same place, "Receive a Holy Spirit." If you forgive the sins of others, your sins shall be forgiven you. If, however, you retain them, that is, in your hearts, then your sins will be retained by God. Do you understand? Greatly abashed and pensive, I answered with a quiet yes, adding immediately, "So you think it is of no value for me, as a priest, to receive the confessions of others, seeing that I cannot grant them absolution? Are you saying that I should discontinue the practice entirely?" "That is not necessary," he replied, "since the Christians of your church believe that they must confess to a priest in order that their sins may be forgiven them, you may continue to take their confessions, with a good conscience, as your office requires. It is not evil or forbidden by God to reveal one's sins to a fellow man. But do not think that you can forgive the sins of your confessants in God's stead. Your duty is confined to removing sinful thoughts from their hearts through advice, admonition and words of comfort and encouragement, so that they may return home as better men and women, and give evidence of their change of heart by their conduct. Perfunctory confession and absolution is not only purposeless, but a desecration of the idea of a reconciliation with God. These questions which you have raised have led me away from my subject, to which I shall now return. Even though portions of Christ's teachings as contained in the copies of the old manuscripts that have come down to you have been purposely omitted or falsified to distort their meaning, enough of the true material still remains to enable people, by using it as a guide, to draw nearer to their God. Unfortunately, they cannot distinguish the true from the false. The foundation of Christ's teachings is, in his own words, "Love God above all things and love your neighbor as you love yourselves." Whoever obeys this command, fulfills the whole of Christian law. All other truths are merely supplements to this fundamental truth and helpful guide to the observance of the law in the life of each individual. And now I come to the last, but no less important reason why Christianity seems to have so little influence on the people of today. They do not find in their spiritual leaders any great observance, in practice, of the teachings of Christianity or of what these leaders themselves preach. That is true of the clergy of all Christian creeds. There are exceptions, but these are comparatively rare. Where can you find clergymen who could stand beside Christ without blushing? How many are there who share suffering, poverty and want with their brothers and sisters, for is that not what the members of their congregations are? Do they serve them as Christ directs, or do they not, in fact, dominate and exploit them? Will they do anything for nothing? Are there not clergymen who even take payment for the prayers they offer? As to the lives they lead, of that I shall say nothing now. It is a matter of which I should like to speak to you some day in private. With these words he turned to me and continued. You plan to visit your family tomorrow. There is no need of such haste. Stay another day and come back here tomorrow evening at 7:30. Then we two can talk in private. So tell this boy through whom I am speaking, as soon as he comes to himself again, to be here at that time. In conclusion he offered a prayer in a language strange to me and, raising his hands in an attitude of benediction, uttered the words. Blessed be you in the name of God, Gruescott. After this salutation the boy again fell forward as he had at the beginning of the meeting, opened his eyes and gazed about in astonishment. He could not understand why the hour was so late. Of what had occurred, he knew nothing. He said he felt as though he had slept long and restfully and that he felt refreshed and perfectly well. When I asked him to come back the next evening at 7:30, he declared that that was impossible. They had some urgent work to finish at his shop, he said, and he would most likely not get home before 9 o'clock. His employer had already notified him of this. Nevertheless, I decided to postpone my trip and come back the next evening at the time that had been specified. As I walked back to my lodgings after the meeting, I felt as though I had awakened from a heavy dream. The moon shed its silvery light on the rooftops and the stars shone peacefully in the clear night sky, but in me the fires of my thoughts blazed fiercely, and I knew that their flames were already licking at the beams on which the whole structure of my faith had heretofore rested. Which told the truth, the creed of which I was a priest, or the voice that had spoken through that boy? Or had he concocted it all out of his own head and staged a farce at our expense? Out of his own head? That boy? No, that was impossible. Rather would I accept any other explanation, however unlikely. I had, of course, here and there read about clairvoyance, the subconscious and telepathy, but none of these seemed to fit the case at hand. I therefore decided to carry my investigation further. I found the subject too important to ignore. For me, there was no turning back. I had to have total clarification. Perhaps the next meeting would carry me another step forward. The decision. After a rather sleepless night, I tried on the following day to relieve my tortured thoughts by strenuous application to work at the office of the Charitable Association. Shortly before 7:30 that evening I was back at the apartment at which the previous evening's meeting had been held. To my great surprise, the boy was there before me. He told me that at 4 o'clock that afternoon his employer had come to him with the announcement that he had changed his mind, and that the work that he had intended to have finished in overtime that evening would be put off until the next morning. I was alone with the boy. As the clock struck 7:30 he again fell forward as he had the day before into that state inexplicable to me, again greeted me with the salutation Gruescott, took my hand and said, I am glad that you have stayed, for I have much to tell you. First of all, however, I must finish the last point of which I was speaking yesterday. You remember that I told you we would speak of that when we were by ourselves. He now drew a picture of the lives led by a great part of the clergy. I listened, shaken and painfully moved. Then, however, he said to me in the most kindly way, now talk to me openly and with complete confidence, for I know that since yesterday you have been in turmoil and that you feel lost. In a voice trembling with inner emotion I answered, you are right, my thoughts are in the whirl. I do not know what to think of it all. Please instruct me in everything. But above all tell me who you are, and how you are able to speak to me through this boy. You are right to ask me first who I am, for it is your duty to test the spirits that speak to you and to assure yourself that they were sent by God, since otherwise you might become the victim of evil spirits that would ruin you, body and soul, and that would not tell you the truth, but by lies would guide you to the path that leads over the edge of the precipice. I swear to you before God that I am one of his good spirits. Indeed one of his highest spirits, but my name keep to yourself. He then told me his name. I am the one who has brought you here. At God's behest I desire to teach you so that you, in turn, may teach your fellow men. All the while I hardly knew how I felt or what was happening to me. I shall now begin, he continued, to instruct you in those things that are taking place here. You may think that what you see is something quite new and unheard of. It is as old as humanity. From the days of the first humans down to the present, the spirit world has communicated with mankind. That is true of both the good spirit world and the bad. You have, of course, read often enough in the ancient texts you call the Old Testament that God spoke to the people. God spoke to Adam, Cain, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, to Moses and to many others. How do you think he did this? You know that God is a spirit and that spirits have no lips of flesh or vocal cords to allow them to speak after the manner of men. How, then, did God speak to these people? I cannot say, was all the answer I could make. And how do you explain the appearance of the three men before Abraham? He knew they were not human beings, but messengers sent by God. Still, he placed food before them and negotiated with them regarding the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. How do you account for that? I had nothing to say in reply. All this I had read hundreds of times and even taught to the children in school. But as to how the communication of the spirits with man, as related in the Bible, was affected, I had neither heard anything nor given it a thought. Although he continued to examine me in these matters, there was not a single question that I succeeded in answering correctly. As you know, you humans have various means of communicating with those who are at a distance from you. You write them letters, telephone or telegraph them, and lately you even make use of ether waves with the radio. Similarly, the world of spirits, which is separated from you by matter, has various ways of communicating with you by means perceptible to your senses. But you people of today do not think about these things. All you do is read about them and let the matter rest there. Take the grand story of Moses. There you find that the angel of the Lord speaks to him from the burning bush, that God daily sends commands for Moses to follow, that the angel of the Lord moves before the people in a pillar of cloud from which it speaks, that Moses asks God for guidance as often as he wishes, and that God always makes answer. The people also could seek counsel of God. They went to the tent of meeting outside the camp, in which Joshua, the servant of Moses, was always required to be present and from which he was not allowed to depart. Now stop and think, why was it that young Joshua was commanded to remain within the tent constantly? Was there any connection between this and the appeals to God for counsel? Like a flash of lightning the answer came to me and I quickly replied, I suppose that Joshua was like this boy here. Just as you are making use of his body in order to speak to me, so in those days the spirit world spoke through Joshua. You are right, he said. But remember that when the Bible says, God spoke, it was very rarely God himself who spoke, because as a rule God speaks only through his spirit messengers. And know, furthermore, that the spirit world does not always speak through a human being when it wishes to speak to mankind. There are many ways in which the spirits can make themselves understood by you. Thus you find that God spoke through the pillar of cloud. In very many cases communication with spirits has been made possible by the gifts of clairvoyance and clairaudience that have been bestowed upon certain individuals. God's speaking with Adam and Eve and with others later was effected by means of clairaudience. There was still another channel the Israelites often used for consulting God, namely the breastplate worn on the robe of the high priest and hence also called the breastplate of judgment. On a later occasion I shall describe to you in detail the proceedings followed when God was consulted through this channel. It is not only in the Old Testament that you will find references to communication with the spirit world, but to the same extent in the New Testament. Each of the Gospels and especially the Acts of the Apostles contain many accounts of revelations made by spirits. Christ himself solemnly promised all who would believe that he would send them God's spirits. The phenomena witnessed during the divine service of the early Christians, for which you of today can find no explanation, were nothing other than the coming and going of spirits. They spoke through one of the worshippers in a foreign tongue and through a second in the mother tongue of the congregation, They gave to a third the power of healing the sick and distributed other gifts, according to the fitness of those upon whom such gifts were bestowed to be tools of the spirit world. In those days these things were of daily occurrence and were looked upon as matters of course. Do not think that communication with the spirits ceased after the early days of the Christian era, as many of the churches ask you to believe. On the contrary, it should and it will continue always, for it is the only way in which you can learn the truth. It is true that it rests with the people themselves whether or not they obtain communication with the spirits of God. Even in the days of the Old Testament there were times when this communication ceased almost entirely. Those were the times of estrangement from God. Today also, the people, in spite of the many temples which they build, have to a great extent fallen away from God and under the power of evil. When the people of today inwardly again draw as close to God as was the case in many a period in the Old Testament and in the early part of the Christian era, all those things that seem so miraculous to you in the reports of those times will take place again. For it is the same God, then as now. He loves his creatures as dearly now as he loved them then, and before him we are all equal. These general teachings must suffice for today. The details concerning the communication between the spirits and mankind you will be taught in due course, if you are willing to receive instruction and to undertake the task that has been reserved for you. You are not compelled to do this. You are free to choose. You may accept what is being offered to you and testify to the truth, or you may decline it and continue on the road you have been traveling heretofore. If you are willing to accept, you will in all probability be called upon to make great worldly sacrifices. You will suffer persecution for the sake of the truth and of right. But you will find peace, if you reject this gift of God that I offer you. However, the responsibility is yours. It is for you to decide. You are not asked to accept anything blindly. You are expected to test whether it is the truth or merely deception by the evil one. You must not be satisfied with hearing of these things from me alone. You must, by your own observations, gather experiences in this field, independently of what you learn here. So, in conclusion, I ask you to look about in your rural parish for persons who have had nothing to do with these matters. Hold weekly meetings with them at a convenient hour, offering prayer and explanation of the scriptures, as did the early Christians. Then pay close attention to whatever happens. In this way you will be in a position to compare what you experience there with what you see and hear here. Also, arrange things so that you can be here in this circle every Sunday evening at 8 o'clock, so that I may continue with my teachings. I am quite ready, I said, to come here every Sunday whenever it is at all possible, but I cannot quite make up my mind to ask any of the simple peasants among my rural parishioners to attend meetings of this sort. In the little village where I live that would attract such great attention, the consequences of which one cannot foresee. Besides, I can think of no one whom I consider suitable for the purpose. If you will make up your mind to act, the rest will be taken care of, he replied to my objection. You are not being forced into this. The decision rests entirely with you. But I would advise you to accept. And now I must conclude. Raising his hands in a gesture of benediction, as he had on the day before, he spoke the words, "May God protect you. May he give you strength to carry out his will. Amen." Gruer Scott. Again the boy sank over forward and after a few moments came to himself, quite unaware of what had taken place. All explanations on any natural grounds that occurred to me I was forced to reject as inadequate. They did not account for even a small fraction of what I had witnessed. What captivated me most of all and, I might say, irresistibly, was the calm clarity and the convincing logic of that which I had heard here for the first time in my life. Only the truth could exert so great an influence from which I had not the power to withdraw, even had I been so inclined. So much of the Bible that had heretofore been obscure to me I now understood quite clearly. What was more, I was just at the beginning. I had been offered thorough instruction in everything connected with the subject, and had only to accept the offer. Furthermore, I was not to be satisfied with what I had heard or would hear here, but was urged to draw upon another, independent source, so that there could be no mistake.